Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this January 1st, 2009. Happy New Year to you. We're going to review 2008 and look toward the stories that will be big, and we can count on what some of them will be: a new presidential administration, an economy that's not doing very well, people losing their jobs, etc. So that will be the focus of our hour today. A good way, I think, to welcome in a new year for those of you who are wide awake and want to talk about what happened and what may happen and should happen in 2009. We welcome your phone calls this morning. We're happy to have Professor Charles Lipson as our guest again. He teaches international relations at the University of Chicago. He's a professor of political science. Research deals with international cooperation and conflict and political aspects of the world economy. He's written a number of books, including most recently Reliable Partners, How Democracies Have Made a Separate Peace. He's also author of Theory and Structure in International Political Economy, Issues and Agents in International Political Economy, and he's also spoken and written extensively about education and academic integrity. Doing Honest Work in College is another of his books, How to Prepare Citations, Avoid Plagiarism, and Achieve Real Academic Success. Our phone number as we celebrate this, or at least mark this beginning of a new year, and maybe there are some things to celebrate about 2008. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. John Treader has come in on this New Year's Day, so we'll wish him a happy New Year as you call in, and we'll talk about 2008. Professor Lipson, happy New Year. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm with you, Kathleen. I feel like we staggered into this. I don't mean from a party. I mean, boy, last year was rough.
I know. I was about to ask you, how rough was it? It was a hard year, wasn't it?
Well, it could have been worse. You could have been Hillary or John McCain.
Yeah, but, that's true.
I mean, Lord, it was bad.
It was bad. So are you hopeful for the new year, or are you one of the— I'm one of these people, for all my life I've always gotten down on New Year's Eve. I have no idea why, but I just get a little bit morose, a little sappy. You know, I go through all the things that could have happened, should have happened, and I'm not usually that way, but there's something about New Year's that just makes me stop in my tracks.
Well, I don't know that I feel that. I kind of like the whole Christmas season and holidays and everything, and I think I sort of began to get that way in the middle of January when I realized all those parties are behind me.
And I see.
So forth, you
right.
know.
And Obama will have left Chicago, right? So you have the excitement
yes,
on the streets.
Those of us in Sheboygan or Milwaukee or Chicago, we kind of envy him being out in Hawaii right now.
Yeah, that's true, although it won't last very long. Well, let's start with the election. We talked about that some yesterday, but it certainly was a huge story. And when you talk about McCain and Hillary, they seem a long time ago, but she was the preordained one. It is amazing that he's going to be the president soon. Still, to me, it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, if we had had a call-in last year at exactly this time, you probably did, and asked people who is likely to be the next president, almost everybody would have said it would be a Democrat, and most people were thinking that the Democrat would be Hillary. And I think it's just extraordinary that Barack Obama, he organized a brilliant campaign. He had exactly the right issue, which is essentially change, and that not only put him on a good footing against the Republicans, it put him on good footing against a return of the Clintons. He was an extraordinarily effective campaigner, and I think the thing that we ought to maybe emphasize that's a little less obvious is that he, just as maybe John Kennedy was the first president of the television age, the first president who really used television effectively, I would say Barack Obama was the first president of the Internet age.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, you're right. It was all organized that way. He got phenomenal support and raised incredible amounts of money, didn't he?
He absolutely. activated lots and lots of young people. I knew a lot of people. I went down to his headquarters several times here in Chicago, essentially in a more as in a reporting mode, or to see my own students who happened to be volunteering there. And boy, I think if you were 25 years old, you felt like the grand old man in the room. You know, thousands of college students, maybe that's an exaggeration, hundreds, who were sitting at computers and doing all sorts of things. They also had very effective things at the rallies, and maybe some of your listeners, when it comes to a time to call in, will say that they did this themselves, which is he asked people to in effect, get on his list so that they could receive the most immediate text messages. And the result of that is that he's got this fabulous electronic mailing list that not only helped him raise money but mobilized people for his side.
Mm-hmm. And what will he use that for now? What does he need to use that to mobilize people for what right now?
Well, I think that, obviously, the number one story aside from the Obama election is the global financial crisis. Mm-hmm. and what he plans to do about it. I mean, I think he's got a whole series of challenges. You know those old jokes that say that the first prize is 1 week in Detroit or Gary or wherever it is, and the second prize is 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Boy, being the president is the second prize here. I mean, he is really facing a series of formidable challenges.
Yes, he certainly is. What about the economy? Are you worried that things are going to tank even more in 2009, or are you hopeful that he will be able to put together and pass a very large economic stimulus package that will put millions of people back to work?
Well, I'd say a little bit of both, and the main feeling I have is tremendous uncertainty. When I talk to people, people who are just, you know, working people who are emptying the waste baskets or working behind the cash register, or when I talk to people who are running businesses, I don't think I've ever seen this amount of sort of generalized fear out there.
Yes.
I don't know. You're talking to a lot of people in your daily job. What's your sense?
I agree with you. I think that there's a great deal of apprehension that people are losing their jobs. It's very difficult. On the other hand, though, people do tend to be hopeful about something new being ushered in. So I don't know which way it's going to go.
I think you're right about that. I think that and if he's successful in turning it around, and of course he'll receive a lot of the credit if things work out well in Iraq, and assuming that things don't really collapse in Afghanistan, another issue that we'll undoubtedly talk about,
mm-hmm.
or Iran, he's in a position to really do a lot to consolidate this victory. But I will say that my hunch is that in the first month or two, what you'll see is very decisive action on the financial crisis. You've emphasized the stimulus package, and we can certainly talk about that. But they've got a lot to do on the financial side, which is to say there are a lot of banks and other lenders out there that are in very shaky shape. And I think that the big lesson from countries like Japan that suffered through, in effect, a 15-year period in which they did not grow, was that you can't drag this out. They left banks dangling for long periods of time, and those banks couldn't lend, and it just prolonged things. So they have a very impressive financial team. I would say, in general, his appointments have been excellent, And I'm not saying that as a partisan. I'm just saying that as an observer, that he's appointed a really experienced team. I wouldn't say on every count, but on I have some questions about what they've done at Homeland Security and a couple of other areas. But in general, I think that these are very impressive appointments. And I think that the financial team is particularly good. Geithner is at Treasury. He's very experienced. He ran the New York Fed. Larry Summers is in the White House. He was the former Treasury Secretary. He's very knowledgeable. And the key appointment in many ways is Paul Volcker. And Volcker is just, you couldn't ask for a more experienced person. He's the guy who stopped inflation and turned things around in the early Reagan administration. He's tough. And my hunch is that if they're thinking about what to do about wobbling financial institutions and the rest, that's a team that I couldn't have more confidence in any other group of people.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about Clinton at State?
It's a very interesting choice. I found the foreign policy statements of President-elect Obama to be the most confusing of all the things that he's done. And let me explain why. He ran, his main theme was, just like Reagan's theme in 84 was Morning in America, you know, that sort of thing. Barack had this big kind of vague theme, change. But to the extent that he had a specific theme, it was that we're going to get out of Iraq much faster. I don't like not only the Bush policy, but I'm running against Hillary on all of these issues. I'm running against Biden, for example. I differ from him on Iraq. And then even before he's elected, he appoints Biden as vice presidential candidate, presumably on the grounds that he looks to him for foreign policy advice. But that's the issue on which he ran against him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he appoints Hillary at State, and again,
right,
that's the issue he ran against her on. So, to tell you the truth, I actually have a lot of confidence in Hillary at State, and I think it was a good appointment politically and so forth. But I find it now perplexing to figure out the president of the United States will be the leader on foreign policy. It won't be Hillary. It won't be Joe Biden. It's going to be Barack Obama. But I'm a little confused since he said one thing in the campaign, and and he seems to be tilting in the other direction. Now, one thing you could make of it, Kathleen, would be that he really thinks that the issue on which his presidency turns is the economy, and that what he wants in place are this very impressive foreign policy team, because it's not just Hillary and Biden. It's keeping Gates on at the Defense Department and putting in place a very experienced guy at the National Security Council. So they put a team in place there that I think he can feel like he can turn to, and he can spend a lot of his time really focusing on the big issues of the economy and turning it around.
Let me ask what can either be a simplistic question or it can be a profound issue for him. It does strike me that one of the major negative things that happened in the past 8 years is the world got a very different image of America. So much has been said about the fact that we lost the confidence. We're not admired by so many countries, so many people now in the world. It seems to me as though it's a rather dramatic change to have an African-American president with the name that he has. It just changes things. His background, for whatever reasons, changes our position in the world. Do you think?
I do. I gave a bunch of speeches this summer in Europe, and worked with the State Department as I went through. I was speaking on my own behalf, but I was brought over by the State Department. And wherever I went, the State Department people, the U.S. diplomats, including fairly senior diplomats, would say the same thing to me. They would say, you need to sort of calm the Europeans down about what they can expect from an Obama presidency. They're so enthused. They think it will turn things around overnight. And so they viewed, and I heard this from people who spoke in other areas and so forth, and if you looked at the polling internationally, you saw this huge support for Obama internationally. There are limits to what he can do.
Sure.
And that's what they were trying to say. But I want to take a little bit of a contrarian view on that. I think that, just to be blunt, I think the sheer incompetence and failures of the Bush administration contributed a lot to that, on top of the policies under when Rumsfeld and Cheney were riding high of a kind of just general insulting approach to collaborating with others. But I think if the Iraq policies had been, from the very outset, the policies that Petraeus pursued, and if we'd had enough people and gone in and succeeded there, a lot of the sort of vitriolic opposition to America, which was opposition to the Bush administration and the policies of Iraq, would have looked a lot different.
Let's welcome phone calls our guest, and we're happy to have him with us this first day of 2009. Professor Charles Lipson teaches international relations at the University of Chicago. He's a professor of political science, and his recent works deal with the problems of forging international cooperation after the Cold War. He's currently writing about the sources of international order in the 19th and 20th centuries, and he has also written extensively and spoken extensively about education and academic integrity. Here's our phone number, the big news of 2008. What a year it was. It was a hard year, I think, don't you? It was a hard year. And let's talk about what might be better in 2009 and the new administration and what's happening in the Middle East. We have yet to spend a lot of time on that. What are the Obama plans for Afghanistan and for Iraq? There's news from Iraq today, as there has been during every day of 2008. The tough economic times that we're facing, and whether or not this administration is going to tackle that first and needs to tackle that first, and if indeed there is so much on the plate that they will be lucky to make progress in any one of the many areas on the plate. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we'll take your phone calls in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Charles Lipson is our guest, and we're going to take phone calls for him right now, 800-486-8655, and we start with Maureen from Green Bay. Happy New Year, Maureen.
Happy New Year to you, too. I just think that your guest, while this is an excellent program, is de-emphasizing the thirst for change out there when he mentioned how young the people were at campaign headquarters. I've been a political junkie all my life, but this year my 67-year-old mother, for the first time, gave money. She volunteered. She had her first ever yard sign, first ever bumper sticker.
In her whole life?
She got text messages from Obama.
Oh, my gosh.
She loved it.
Huh.
And I think that the most important thing that Obama can do is keep that involvement going. You know, what can we do to make this country better and to get us back on track? I think we will listen to him, where I don't think we took Bush seriously or, you know, McCain had any answers.
And let me ask you before we go to Professor Lipson, why was this the election that got your mother so excited?
The first part was Hillary. She and her women friends were so excited to see a woman. And then they really, and particularly Hillary, they're from New York. And then Obama just ignited them with his energy and his passion. And they feel that the rich white men are completely out of touch with our lives And Obama gets it. And Obama was the one who could make change, and it just electrified them.
Hmm. Professor Lipson.
I didn't mean to de-emphasize the interest in change, and I think your guest is exactly right. I would say that Obama's very strong victory indicated that. But it's also the case that the thirst, that it's not like he won 60% of the vote or 65% of the vote. You could say that it is striking that considering the incredible and abject failures and manifest incompetence of the Bush administration, it's kind of amazing. And the fact that McCain didn't run a very good campaign, was clearly old, appointed somebody who to run for vice president who was not qualified, in the opinion of most people, including myself, to become to stand in as president. It's kind of amazing that he came as, he got something like 47% of the vote, 46% of the vote. So, I mean, I think your guest is absolutely right. She also pointed to something that was interesting that I noted, and I'd like to ask her if she noted this among her friends as well, that in the Democratic primary, there really was a difference in among women. Women who had been part of the initial feminist movement tended to support Hillary. That meant that maybe women who were older than 40, 45 tended to back Hillary, and then younger people backed Obama. As soon as Hillary lost, they happily switched over, I would say, to Obama. Did you find that?
She left us, I'm afraid, but
oh,
I'll answer for her.
She
I
left
think,
us
yeah.
to pull down those yard signs.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's true, don't you? And everybody was saying that wasn't going to happen. Oh, they're not going to vote. They're going to go to McCain, et cetera. And they didn't. They went to him right away.
You're absolutely right. They switched over. The theme of there weren't big differences, to tell you the truth, on policy between Hillary and Barack, except perhaps on foreign policy, which goes back to your first question about how she'll perform at the State Department.
Thanks very much, Maureen, for the call. Let's go to Joe from Milwaukee next. Happy New Year, Joe.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks for taking my call. First of all, I'd like to address this envy of Obama in Hawaii. You know, I'm on the other side of that. I envy Palin in Alaska. I suspect I'm in a minority, but I'd much rather be playing in the snow.
Well, you got plenty of it in Milwaukee, Joe. You don't need to go anywhere.
It's melting. It's
yeah, that's
disappearing.
True. That's true.
Anyways, on to this. You touched on this internet mobilization.
No, I've lost all confidence in your judgment. If you want to go to Alaska right now, I'm not sure what I can take seriously.
You know, I spent 3 years up there, and it was pretty much the best 3 years of my life. I just, you know,
really?
I'm a cold weather guy.
Huh.
I see. Huh. Well, what's your question?
Well, the question, more of a comment. This internet mobilization Obama was able to corral during the campaign. I have a friend, a journalism scholar in China, who writes and studies this internet mobilization over there, and they do that to get around the party-controlled press. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what the chances of, you know, the people seemed more in tune or know where to go to get information over there. Over here, it's just, you know, there's such a variety of stuff on the internet, and it's not concentrated. I wonder what the chances of doing that in the shadow of the corporate press over here to mobilize. Now, Obama found a way, apparently, to mobilize a large chunk of our society, and I don't know.
I think this is just a fascinating question, and a program or many programs all to themselves. I think we're getting news and information, entertainment in whole new ways. I think there's been, you know, when I was a kid, everybody watched the same, one of the same three or evening news shows. You watched ABC, CBS, or NBC. You got your local newspaper, whether it was the Milwaukee Journal or the Chicago Tribune or New York Times or whatever it was. And what's happening today is just this vast proliferation of sources of news. I noticed the last time that we were on, Wisconsin Public Radio was getting calls from from Iowa and so forth. And I've had friends tell me that they listen to this show on the internet all over the country. So I think that this is changing very rapidly. And I would say that in general, it's just tremendously good. But there is one kind of dark side to the cloud, which is that it's possible, if you're a real left-winger, to get all your news from the Daily Kos and the Huffington Post, and if you're a right-winger, to get all your news from Fox News, and on the internet you can get your news from a number of different websites which are designed specifically to appeal to you. So I think that there's a kind of fragmentation in what we're looking at, and I also see that a bit in the public sphere. I mean, you notice that people increasingly are walking down the street with buds in their ears, listening to iPods and so forth. So I fear both a kind of isolation and a fragmentation. But in general, I would say that we have many, many more sources, and that's just all to the good.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Earl from Medford next. Hi, Earl.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
You too, Earl.
I wanted to ask about just changing the whole U.S. approach, that we stop being international bullies, and if Obama's going to carry forth on prohibiting waterboarding and specific activities, also closing Guantanamo and similar facilities.
Yes, I think that that's a critical point that you're making, Earl. I think that he's going to change fairly rapidly the perception that it's our way or the highway. And I think that we suffered badly internationally from Abu Ghraib and from Guantanamo. There's some serious problems in closing Guantanamo, because most of the people have actually already been released from there. But the ones who are left are the really very difficult ones to figure out what to do with. But it looks like what we'll do is we'll probably transfer them to some place like Fort Leavenworth and give them trials in the U.S., even if it involves releasing some classified information. I think that will change the perception.
I am so struck by the amount of time that so many of those people have been there, many of whom, from my understanding from talking with people who know about the situation, may be perfectly innocent.
Yes. I think that I've talked with lawyers who've gone down there and represented people and so forth, and there are some horror stories like that. I've got to say, the whole situation was really unprecedented. You weren't fighting a war in which the other side was wearing uniforms and there are standard rules about what you're supposed to do with prisoners of war. And you weren't fighting for a lot of the period in a country that even had an effective government locally, either in Afghanistan or in Iraq, where you could take the people who were captured on the battlefield and turn them over to that government. So it was a very difficult situation. But and I would differentiate the issue of capturing and holding people from the issues of waterboarding. And I would, in other words, torture. And I would differentiate the issues of habeas corpus. We could have given people many more legal rights And we could have avoided torture entirely. And it's far from clear, and in fact, I've just read recent articles about this, that show how ineffective torture is. But whether it's effective or not, the sort of ticking time bomb scenarios that people talk about and so forth, it's just so deeply opposed to what Americans, what we think we're fighting for in the world, and what our allies think we should be fighting for, that we've really suffered badly for it. You're absolutely right, and Earl and others are right.
Earl, thanks for your call. We have a couple lines open now if you'd like to join us on this New Year's Day. 800-486-8655. Professor Charles Lipson is our guest. He is the founder and co-director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security at the University of Chicago, where he's a professor of political science. And we're talking about 2008, the stories that were hard, the hope that we had for the new year and what's to be tackled in 2009. Dave from Wisconsin Rapids is our next caller. Happy New Year, Dave.
Well, Happy New Year, Kathleen. Good morning to you and your guest, Charles. And I appreciate this opportunity. My wife and I are sitting here listening to your show, and we were having our morning coffee and playing our daily game of cribbage.
And that's a nice image.
And we've been doing this since 1978. We're over 17,000 games now. But in any event, we've been discussing the world situation and our own economic situation since the election and prior to it. And, of course, there's plenty to worry about. But when we think about President Obama moving into the White House, it's enough to make us smile. And we tend to be pretty much left of center, but we're kind of in that middle spectrum. I suspect that people, both from the far left and the far right, the people who are looking at the blogs that your guest was talking about just previously, are going to be disappointed, and they're going to find that President Obama is going to govern from the sensible center. But the thing that really made us smile was when my wife said, just imagine if we were sitting here talking about the coming year and it was going to be John McCain and Sarah Palin moving into the White House. And that was enough to put a smile on us for probably the rest of this month anyway. And, again, I appreciate this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the call.
Well, those are widely shared sentiments. I've also been struck by the absence of bitterness after the campaign.
Yes, I have too.
I thought McCain did a wonderful thing. His acceptance. His concession speech, the one accepting the Obama victory, was very generous. And I thought that President-elect Obama's speech in Chicago on the night that he did accept set exactly the right tone. Instead of being a kind of triumphalist, me first speech, it was a serious speech about that recognized the historic moment and then said we have real challenges to face. So I thought in that sense it was how you like to see an election in a democracy end, with the losing party making a generous concession and the winning party taking its responsibilities very seriously.
Mm-hmm. And there doesn't seem to be, maybe I'm not perceiving this correctly, but maybe it's because McCain set the tone. There doesn't seem to be a lot of, oh, we lost, and I'm not very enthusiastic about this guy. There seems to be, well, he won, and he's our president, and it's okay. There's an it's okay attitude, I think, among people who voted for McCain.
I think that's absolutely right. I wouldn't get too carried away, though, because I think that as we go into the big issues that are going to come before Congress, there's going to be serious debates, as there should be. we are giving this financial aid package, the TARP money and so forth, it's nearly $1 trillion, and it's completely opaque under under Paulson and the Bush administration. People are going to want to know where this money's going, and they're going to want to see how it's spent. Mm-hmm. And I think there's going to be serious debates about that, as well there should be. I also think that the Republicans really have to go back to the drawing board. They have to decide. And, of course, there's not – in America, these parties are very diffuse. It's not like the Democratic Party in its organizational sense would have ever nominated Obama. Obama came out of nowhere. He built his own group of Democrats that won the party's primary. But there's going to be a contestation within the Republican Party as they try to figure out how did they go from being so dominant at one point, to being in such a devastated position now. And one more thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think people haven't fully grasped, and maybe even President-elect Obama has not fully grasped, that as part of the victory, he won a lot of centrist states in the Mountain West and in the South, in the Upper South. There were no people appointed to the cabinet from the South, for example. But there are going to be a lot of people who are in the new Congress from those more elected from those more centrist areas. And it'll be an interesting issue to see whether he reaches out to them as part of his political, as part of being an adroit political leader.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about 2008 and looking to the new year, this first day of the new year, with Professor Charles Lipson. He's at the University of Chicago, where he's founder and co-director of the Program on International Politics, Economics, and Security. He's a professor of political science. We have one line open if you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Following the news from National Public Radio, I don't know if you knew this or not, but today happens to be the beginning of the International Year of Astronomy. It's a global celebration, and its purpose is to stimulate greater interest in astronomy and also science. We'll be talking with a co-editor of Astronomy Magazine, which is published right here in Milwaukee, about the top 10 stories of 2008. And every time I talk about these issues, all I can say is, wow. So that's the second hour of our show. All right, back to phone calls. We go next to Charles from Ingleside. Hi, Charles.
Good morning, or Happy New Year.
You too.
I wonder what the Speaker thinks of Obama's backing of Bush's policy or lack of restraint on the monetary policy and on Israel.
Let me. Those are quite separate issues, so let me take them up. Charles, I like your name. It seems to me that Obama has, in general, wisely stayed on the sidelines on virtually everything. In fact, there's a lot of pressure on him to come out and give a specific statement about what he thinks about what's going on in Gaza, but he hasn't done that. Really, other than to say there's one president at a time. So I guess what I would say is we don't know what his policies on either of those issues are. If you want to say more, I'm happy to go on, but I think the main point is that he's tried to avoid being drawn into any of those policies.
Should he say more now?
I think that on the international scene, there's a lot to be said about having one president at a time. On the other hand, he shouldn't be doing anything that would undercut a kind of clarity of the U.S. position unless he feels strongly that he wants to send an alternative signal. It doesn't seem like he does. My sense is that on both domestic financial issues and international issues, he's very much getting briefed, and if he wanted to say anything differently or if his officials did, they would do so. I think what's happening behind the scenes is actually that they're working very hard and quietly to get their appointments made. We see these high-profile appointments to the cabinet. Actually, last time you'll remember, Kathleen, we got a lot of questions about agriculture, and including one from Iowa, and the appointment there was to have the Iowa governor, who's very experienced in dealing with these issues. But the United States government is unique in that we have political appointments that go four levels down, which is kind of like a pyramid. So it's not just the number two person, and often they're not two or three number two people in each department. They're 20 number threes, and they're 40 number fours. They're on the order of a couple of thousand people that have to be appointed across all of these different departments. Those involve coordination between the new secretary, say, Richardson at Commerce, and the Obama administration, who's going to get appointed. So I think they've got their plate pretty full right now.
Thanks, Charles, so much for your call. We go to Tom from Burlington. Hello.
Good morning. I get a little blue myself on New Year's. It's kind of scary looking at the new year. But I'd like to point out that there's a forest in Israel named after my father, Charles Boyle, and he helped David Ben-Gurion when they got the country, when they first started in the 50s. And the problem that I see in our relationships with Israel is many presidents cannot decide the difference between supporting the state of Israel and supporting a prime minister of Israel. And, for instance, Mr. Sharon went over there to the Temple Mount and caused all kinds of trouble 16 or 20 years ago. And we all have our favorite presidents who we support in America, and I think we should step back and say, we like this prime minister, or we don't like this prime minister. And I'd like your views on that.
I think that's exactly right. I think our policy with respect to every country, Israel included, ought to be to figure out what's in America's interest and to pursue that. With regard to Israel, since both of the last two callers have been named Charles and both of the last two callers have asked about Israel, let me say something about it. I would say the first point in general is that I think it's almost impossible for the United States to make peace there or anywhere else, say between Pakistan and India or anywhere else, unless the principal parties involved want to make that peace themselves and are able to make it. And I would say that the issues involving Hamas right now, which is labeled as a terrorist group, I haven't heard anything from President-elect Obama that differs from that assessment. In fact, he said quite directly that he considers it a terrorist group. They're the ones who were lobbing missiles in and so forth daily at civilians. So I don't see, and the United States position has been that Israel is within its rights to strike back. I don't see where the Obama administration is going to take a different tact on that. Where they might well take a different tact will be with respect to Iran. And we haven't talked about Iran, but Iran is just a tremendous threat through the whole region. The United States policy will essentially be containment. We don't know what the Israeli policy will be. Israel doesn't really have a government right now.
And what about the different tack that we might take? What would you recommend?
Toward what?
Iran.
Toward Iran?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that the fundamental question is whether or not the United States wants to make some last effort, which would have to go beyond economic sanctions, but might not go as far as the use of military force to stop Iran from a nuclear proliferation. I see no thirst at all for doing that. But make no mistake, Iran as a nuclear power is a very dangerous aspect of the region. Israel's had nuclear weapons for a long time. It presumably can deter them. But Iran is quite likely to share its technologies with its friends and allies in the region, or at least that's a very real threat. And I should also say that Pakistan, which is unstable and has nuclear technologies, could also share that. So I think these are very dangerous problems that the incoming administration is going to face.
Right. Thanks, Tom, for your call. And let us go to Craig from Heartland. Hi, Craig.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for your show. You're awesome.
Thank you.
But I get a little bit personal here.
Charles, you're awesome. We love you, Charles.
Is there a way to prosecute the outgoing administration? Dick Cheney is a war criminal. What he's done to our Constitution is unbelievable. How do we prosecute somebody that's... I don't just want him slipping off into shadows and running our government anyway. How do we do that?
Well, you ask how, but let me... and the answer is, any charges that are brought against them that are legal charges would go through our system. I mean, one of the things that we learned during the Nixon administration was that the courts have a tremendous autonomy. Once an issue is raised as a real legal issue, it can go through that system. On the other hand, I really feel that the United States has moved too far toward making political differences into legal and even criminal matters. And I don't think that's a good thing. Let me give you an example from my own state of Illinois, that pantheon of good government. Our attorney general tried to bring a suit to have the governor Blagojevich, removed from office on the grounds that he was unfit to serve. And the Constitution of the state of Illinois doesn't specifically mention that you have to be ill, but it says if you're unable to serve, you can be removed by the courts. Well, it seemed to me that what was contemplated there was if you had a stroke or you were incapacitated in some way, that the courts could step in because there wouldn't be time to do it some other way. But what he's being accused of is corruption and misuse of office. That's a political issue. It ought to be handled at the political level. It's not fundamentally a legal issue, except that he's going to be tried, and properly so, in the court. Once he's indicted for trying to sell these offices and various kinds of corruption. That should be handled legally. But what should be done to him in terms of removal from office shouldn't be done through the courts. It should be done through the Congress. And through the state legislature. And I think that the same thing is largely true at the federal level. That is, if there have been actual crimes committed, then those can be handled by the courts. But I think if what we're talking about is real political differences, I think we should back away from turning everything into a court issue. I hope that our new president, for example, is not bogged down in one lawsuit after the next, and that political issues will actually be decided in the Congress and in the Senate.
And thanks very much for the call. Professor Lipson, Happy New Year to you. I like your style, and we We want to have you on again soon. Thanks so much for being with us.
I perked you up. You certainly perked me up.
Thanks for being with us. We need to talk about Blagojevich some hour soon. All right. We thank Professor Charles Lipson, professor of political science and director of the program on international politics, economics, and security at the University of Chicago for being with us this very first day of 2009. We thank Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Treader for coming in on New Year's Day, and thanks for all of your calls. We'll return following the news from National Public Radio.